We're back. It's the D'Antonio Weencast with me, Ben from Blazers Edge, and Kevin Pelton from Basketball Perspectives. Kevin, so glad we could get you finally on the phone to discuss. I know it's been a busy week with your successful heart surgeries every morning and re-coordinating the president's launch codes for the nuclear weapons, but glad you could fit us in, and let's go ahead and get this going.
Yeah, I mean, we should better make this snappy. I've got a busy afternoon planned, too.
Yeah, well, I understand your chef from your personal chef who also has a day job at Jack in the Box is going to be bringing food over to you at any point during this podcast. So try not to chew too loudly into the microphone, and I'll just go on a 15-minute rant about, I don't know, Jared Bayless, and that way you'll have enough time to eat your perfectly manicured lunch.
It's a win for both of us.
Perfect. How's it going, KP2? I saw some of you this week. It's been a while. You were down at two of the games. What was it, Friday? For the Lakers, and then what was it, Wednesday or Monday or Tuesday, or all the days are running together for the Milwaukee Bucks. Neither one of those games really lived up to expectations in terms of competitiveness, did it?
No, not really. You know, I especially thought the Lakers game would, if anything, be the Lakers taking it to a shorthanded Blazers team. So, I was definitely impressed with what I saw from the Blazers that night and their fans, obviously. And then, yeah, Milwaukee, I mean, you figured that would probably be a win, certainly, in that category. But, boy, the Bucks were amazingly uncompetitive for three quarters.
Well, here's my question. Are we getting to the point of the season where teams realize they have to travel to Portland, they know the Rose Garden mystique, tough place to win, and teams maybe are just kind of coming in and rolling over? Because it didn't seem to me like the Lakers really much cared whether they won that game or not. Before the game, during the game, or after the game. They didn't really seem, particularly angry about it afterwards. They were pretty dismissive. And then the Bucks, I mean, what can you say about that? They gave up a 30-plus point first quarter, really couldn't stop anything. They played with some energy. They do play hard for Skiles, but it wasn't like, they were ever really competitive. I mean, our team's starting to get to that point where, okay, we're going to Portland. That's going to be a loss. Are they just circling that on their schedules?
I mean, I don't know about that. It wasn't that long ago that Philadelphia came in here on a losing streak and beat the Blazers. So, I think Milwaukee was in the middle of a six-game road trip. I think it was the fourth game. And, I mean, just, Portland played really well. I mean, that was a game where I think you looked at me early on and wondered whether Brandon Roy's motivation was going to be there on a Wednesday night against Milwaukee, which is one of the challenges with an 82-game schedule in this league. But clearly it was, ultimately, as he played very well, and pretty much everyone played well, and it was a bad matchup for Milwaukee with Brandon Jennings trying to defend Andre Miller. So, I think it was just a combination of that.
So here's my question for you. A lot of people, the new storyline for the Blazers, kind of in wake of some of these wins, and even a pretty competitive performance against Cleveland, even though they're, in the loss, but they played them tight down to the fourth quarter. It was tied at one point. They kind of had some execution breakdowns, which I wrote about earlier this week, that ended up leading to the loss. But, they hung tight with some of the league's best teams, and they beat the Lakers. Are the Blazers really overachieving, or are we not giving their current personnel enough credit? I mean, aren't these guys good enough to compete as they have been? Are they really overachieving, or is it just our expectations are still out of whack from all the injuries?
I would say a little bit of both. I mean, when you look at the roster going in, we knew that one of the strengths was going to be depth, and kind of one of the weaknesses was going to be depth in terms of Nate McMillan trying to manage minutes and keep everyone happy and things like that. So to that standpoint, it's almost been a blessing in disguise to have these injuries, because you've been able to get minutes for a guy like Jared Bayless, and things like that. On the other hand, I would say that up front, the Blazers are probably overachieving, because if you would have told me that Juwan Howard was going to be the starting center and asked me to predict what Portland's record would be with that configuration, it certainly would have been a more pessimistic outlook, and indeed it was, I think, the last time we did this podcast right after Prez Bello got hurt. So, I think there is an element of that. And, as we've talked about, again, I just feel like this Blazers team under Nate McMillan plays best when its back is to the wall, when everyone's against them.
So here's my question for you regarding Howard. So obviously he's exceeded expectations, and I think expectations for him were out of whack. And, you know, compared to his performance, like you said, I mean, he's definitely stepped up in ways in terms of minutes, in terms of production, that I don't think anyone really predicted. Certainly we didn't predict. But is that sustainable? I mean, do you think that, I mean, is he just still that good? Has he found that, you know, second wind, or maybe in his case, maybe sixth or seventh wind of his career, where he's going to be able to perform like that from now through, you know, potentially the playoffs? I mean, is that the kind of quality he is? Can they expect the same from him over the next, you know, 3 or 4 months? Because if so, what's the motivation to make a move, you know?
Well, I would say, you know, there's different elements of it. I mean, part of it is the fact that, you know, by my statistics, you know, that I do, Juwan Howard still is not playing that well, really. You know, he's still, I think, maybe even below replacement. But all Portland is asking him to do is a couple things. You know, defend the post, be in the right position on defense, hit the open 15-footer from time to time. You know, they're not asking him to go out there and be Greg Oden or even to be Joel Prisbilla. They're doing a good job of playing to his strengths and kind of minimizing his weaknesses. And I think that he can do that, you know, continue to do that. I think that the rate, you know, the way he's been knocking down that 15-footer probably is not going to continue all season long. At some point, you're going to go to the slot machine and it's going to stop paying out. But, you know, I don't think that there's necessarily a tremendous urgency to make a move.
Well, is it just me, or does he shoot that shot a lot of times when maybe he doesn't even need to either? You know, he's a confident guy, and they're giving him the green light to shoot it. But a lot of it's not like he's shooting it necessarily with 1 second left on the shot clock, and it's like, you know, a four-step shot. I mean, he's shooting it from within the offense. So if he does go cold, they've got other options, and you would expect him to probably take less shots down the stretch, you know?
Yeah, I mean, at some point, I think you're putting a lot of pressure on the other guys to score if you're in a situation where Howard is not even looking at the basket at all. You know, that's where you get a lot more aggressive, teams a lot more aggressive in their double teaming of Brandon Roy. I mean, you know, I'm kind of surprised. I'll throw this out there to you. Did you expect teams to do more to take Roy out of his game? Because the only team that I can think of lately that's really succeeded in that is the Clippers.
To take Roy out of his game?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought the Cavs did a great job in taking Roy out of his game, especially late. I thought they, you know, with the double team up top, he looked really frustrated, really out of sorts, making uncharacteristic errors, you know, hanging his head a little bit. And I'm not sure why every team doesn't just hard double him and make somebody else beat them. It seems like the most logical defensive strategy you would ever do. You know, I put that post up with some of the pictures about how they were doing it. And it really helps when you have LeBron James, you know, who's arguably probably the best defender in the league, or definitely up there, you know, with Dwight Howard and some of the other guys, who could just, you know, basically make Brandon not be able to drive around him and pick him up, you know, 2 or 3 feet above the three-point line. So he, you know, really limited his options in terms of how the pick and rolls would work, you know, where he could get to a shot from 15 feet. But I thought they did a great job on him. You know, Clippers did a similar thing, doubling to get the ball out of his hands. Maybe teams don't trust their defenses to rotate well enough and to, you know, they're worried about getting beat on the backside, or maybe they're worried about the Blazers shooters beating them. But, I mean, it seems to me that's the way to beat the Blazers. The Cavs kind of gave everybody the blueprint on defense in terms of how you limit Brandon. I mean, Brandon still had a good game. You know, he put up 30-plus, but it was in a losing effort, and they definitely made him work for it. He had more turnovers than usual. So, you know, that's kind of where I'm wondering – if this can be sustainable, is if, one, if Brandon can stay healthy given how many minutes he's had to play, and hopefully Rudy coming back will help that. But two, will teams finally realize that, you know, other teams around the league have had success doubling him so hard, and, you know, just take that up as a strategy?
Yeah, I think that those are very good points. There's not a lot of margin for error in the style that the Blazers are playing right now. You know, if one thing goes wrong, especially in terms of the way Brandon Roy is playing and his role in the offense, then, you know, it could all go south in a hurry.
The weird thing about that same post, that executions post, is to, like, look down the stretch against the Cavs, and it wasn't necessarily indicative of how they execute down the stretch of most games. And I think, you know, we saw almost the opposite, actually, in the next game against Milwaukee, where Aldridge was much more active and effective and getting more looks and moving better. But against the Cavs, I mean, you look at some of the time, you know, I took some screen grabs of, you know, when the decisions were made on those possessions, you know. So, in other words, is Brandon going off the pick? Is he, you know, pulling up for a shot or whatever? I mean, on multiple possessions down the stretch, Aldridge was out of bounds or so far on the weak side that Brandon couldn't even see him. There was four defenders between him and Brandon, being totally out of the plays. And, you know, probably one of the things that bothers me the most about, you know, general feelings towards LaMarcus, you know, this idea that he's soft, doesn't rebound enough or whatever. You know, it's hard to get 10-plus rebounds a game if you're completely out of the offense for the entire fourth quarter and you're just on the weak side, you know, scrounging for whatever rebounds might be over there, and you're playing alongside Juwan Howard, you know. I mean, 12 minutes out of the 48 minutes, that's a lot of potential rebounds that he's not going to be able to get, or potential points he's not going to be able to get because he's not even really involved in the offense. So I kind of felt bad for him. It reminded me of what Greg was going through at the beginning of the season, where it was like he didn't get passes. You know, the only time he touched the ball is when he grabbed an offensive rebound, and it kind of felt like that's how it was for Aldridge against the Cavs, even though he was incredibly hot, and he was, you know, they didn't really have anyone who could stop his jumper. It was kind of frustrating for him, I think, and also frustrating to watch because, you know, when the isolation breakdowns or the high pick and rolls don't work for the Blazers, that offense gets pretty ugly pretty quick.
Well, I thought that the Milwaukee game was really one of the best jobs I've seen all season in terms of kind of mixing in all sorts of different weapons, because you had Brandon, you know, having a very efficient game. You had Aldridge contributing 20 points, getting lots of looks in the post, and then Andre Miller also getting a chance to back down smaller defenders. So I really thought that, you know, that's kind of the template for what the Blazers will want to do in terms of, you know, mixing in all those guys. And you know, there'll be other guys on different nights. You know, maybe there'll be Jared Bayless who's got the matchup advantage as opposed to Andre Miller or something like that. But, you know, just getting three guys nearly to 20 points is an impressive accomplishment for Portland.
Hey, did you agree with my take after that Milwaukee game that that was the best we've seen Miller go into the post and really exploit, you know, his, you know, dream shake moves and up and unders and ability to draw fouls and his size? I mean, have we seen that from him this year to that same degree as he was able to post up on Jennings? I mean, it seemed like he really worked Jennings pretty hard. Both Nate and Brandon were pretty complimentary of Miller's ability to do that. Brandon even said they've been working on new sets to kind of take advantage of that more. I mean, is that the first time we've seen that? Or maybe when they had centers like Prisbilla or Odin, it just wasn't going to work if Andre was trying to do that. But now that they don't really have a true center, maybe he'll be able to see more, or maybe we'll be able to see more of that, because it seemed like it was a really high percentage look, easy buckets. You know, I mean, they didn't really have a choice. They either had to double him and had to foul him, or he made the basket. I mean, it's pretty simple stuff.
No, I mean, I think that, you know, we've seen flashes of it here and there, but in terms of consistently over a game, that was clearly the most effective and the most frequently Miller has been in the post. You know, I think it's true that it's a little bit different when you have Howard playing from about 15 feet to space the floor as opposed to Odin or Prisbilla, you know, being right around the basket. We've talked about Andre Miller, the issue that he creates with spacing, but if he's the guy who's in the post as opposed to somebody else is out there stretching the floor, then it's a whole different issue, and suddenly the fact that he's not a three-point shooter doesn't come into play at all. So, you know, maybe where that could be even more effective is when the Blazers start playing more small lineups, as you've been hammering home lately.
Well, yeah, so two things on that. One, the idea that you could have a Miller-Roy-Rudy three-guard lineup, with Rudy being the one spacing the floor and Miller in the post, with Brandon up top or somewhere else as another option that people obviously have to spend a defender on because you can't leave Brandon, that to me seems like it could be really, really ruthless. And that's a tough combo to defend. Now, obviously, you're asking Brandon to go play defense on the three, so you maybe don't want to do that for a long stretches, but to me that seems like an awesome lineup to be able to exploit some mismatches out of the post like that. But anyway, going back to the small lineup. So, yeah, we definitely need to get your take on this just to reset it. Probably about 2 or 3 days ago, or maybe earlier this week, literally the entire season's running together at this point. I have no idea what day. I think it's Friday today, but you could have told me it was Tuesday. I would have had no idea. But earlier this week, I was watching Nicholas Batum out at practice. And, you know, he's getting pretty close to where he's feeling like he's going to be ready to play in games. You know, he's a lot smoother. He's moving really well. Doesn't really seem to be experiencing any discomfort in his shoulder, which they say is, you know, how it works after you have that shoulder surgery, is you feel really good pretty soon after it. And it's just a matter of letting your body heal to the point where you're not going to re-aggravate it or something like that. But he's working with Monty, and he looks like he's put on some weight to his frame. He just looks ridiculously long compared to a guy like Martell Webster. I mean, Martell Webster's been, a pretty good defender. He stepped up, especially against Kobe. Did a nice job against LeBron. Obviously shut down Durant earlier this year that we talked about. That one defensive performance has got more runs than almost anything else. But Martell Webster has been good. But Nicholas Batum is just like otherworldly length. And his arms are so much longer. He almost looks like he's taller. Maybe that's just sort of a yeah, an eye trick because we haven't seen him play so long. But he just looks like this physical specimen, this physical freak. I started thinking, like, you know what? This guy would probably be able to do just about anything that Travis did, minus some of the fallaway turnaround jumpers. And he could probably do everything that Travis did on defense better because he's smarter. He's not going to get beat back door. His footwork's a lot better. I think he has underrated strength. And you look at the other options, a guy like Dante Cunningham, who is kind of a similar, little bit, limited on offense player. He can shoot the face up, but he's not really going to take the ball off the dribble. He's got good core strength on defense, so he's kind of a stretch four kind of guy. He's going to get overpowered in the post against the bigger fours. And I just kind of started thinking, well, is there anything that Dante can do on defense that Nick can't do? And I was like, well, no, not really. So all of this led me, the roundabout way to think, why doesn't he play four? It makes sense. Given all the guards they've got healthy and all the posts they have injured, somebody's going to have to move into that four spot, and there's open minutes, and why wouldn't it be Nicholas? It's going to be Nicholas or Martell potentially. Now, this morning, Hollinger took up the same subject, which I don't know if you saw before. He just posted it before recording this, but he's basically saying, with Batum coming back and then Outlaw coming back soon after that, he says that Nate could definitely go to a four guard lineup, if you want to call it that, and that the injuries to Portland's two stretch four candidates have limited its ability to play small this year, but such units could provide Roy with the space he needs while blunting the negative impact of Miller's poor outside shooting. So that was Hollinger's take on it. So he seems to be kind of in favor of the idea of a four guard lineup. Talked to Nate about it yesterday. Nate kind of co-signed the entire idea, saying that Nick would be able to handle any of the stretch fours defensively. He would probably be able to handle some of the bigger fours, if he fronted them and they helped him on the weak side. He didn't really see any problems with it. So what's your take, expert? Can Nick play as a four in the Blazers system? And if not, would you prefer Martell plays in the four, or would you just squeeze Nick in at the three where he's been and go from there?
Well, I did see Hollinger's story first off, and I'm curious how much you paid him or what kind of evidence you have on him that you've agreed to bury, that you got him to take that up so quickly after you started obsessing on this idea.
Well, I think that it's clear that Hollinger and Chad Ford are the two biggest Blazers edge readers in the entire universe. I mean, these guys, no, I'm kidding, but Chad Ford has had a few times in the past where it kind of made everybody on the site raise their eyebrows, thinking like, did he just read that on Blazers Edge and then repost it on ESPN? But no, I was proud to have beaten Hollinger to this punch. It's not often that happens. You know Hollinger. I mean, he's on top of everything. And honestly, I think Hollinger might write more words about the NBA per week than anybody else in the NBA blogosphere. I was looking at his archive today. That guy has like 15 stories this week. It's ridiculous. So he's all over everything. He's all over the Blazers, obviously. He's got all the connections in the world. So this is the one chance where I was able to beat him by, what, 11 hours. And then he wrote it better than I did, of course, typical. So I didn't pay him anything. It's just, brilliant minds think alike, Kevin. It really is what it is. And one of these days, we'll let you hang out with
Really makes me wonder why we disagree so much on this podcast. No, it was specifically getting to the notion of Batum at the four. I think my big concern with that lineup is the issue of rebounding. I think defensively, I agree with you. I'm a little leery of Batum spending time defending much bigger players right after, coming back from shoulder surgery. I can see where that would maybe be an issue. But I think that I'm generally in favor of small ball. The last time we did this wing cast, we were talking about how to replace Prisbilla, and Juwan Howard wasn't really an option that we were thinking was going to be viable. And my solution was a lot more LaMarcus Aldridge at the five, and even going to Martell at the four, which obviously is not much different in terms of rebounding. And he's even a little bit smaller, as you said. So, you know, as compared to that, I think it's definitely a good option. You're right that it's a way to get Batum minutes. You know, the other thing is I think we do want to probably wait and see where exactly Batum is at. You know, when a guy's been out as long as he has, there's definitely going to be rust, especially for a young guy that's developing. You know, I think we know. I was talking about this the other day with regard to Blake Griffin missing his rookie season. I think the big thing is, like, you know, this summer, instead of being able to go out and work on things to get better, Blake Griffin is going to be rehabbing to get back to the point where he was before he got hurt. And, you know, seeing that firsthand with Nick Collison, when he missed an entire surgery season, he had surgery on both of his shoulders. They decided to just call his rookie season off, you know, ahead of time and do both of his shoulders as opposed to Batum having just the one shoulder surgery. He came back the next year and he was good, but he definitely struggled early on with his timing, and his shooting was especially not nearly as good as we expected it to be. You know, I think largely because of the fact that he didn't have the chance to work on it that offseason. So, you know, there's a chance that Batum might come back and not be Nicholas Batum we remember as being a very useful asset from last year, and I don't think it necessarily says anything about where he's going in the future or his long-term ability, but it might just be, you know, the nature of sitting out so long.
Yeah, I think there could definitely be a ramp-up period, but I'll tell you, I'll be honest, I have the highest expectations possible for Nick Batum. This guy was a beast last year. He was looking good over the summer before he had to deal with the shoulder. Just, he's a gym freak. I mean, he's, as far as, you know, the guys who are the most impressive in the gym, just watching them work out and practice, watching what they can do with the basketball. I mean, he just drops your jaw. There's not many guys on the Blazers. I mean, obviously, you know, LaMarcus Aldridge, Brandon Roy, those kinds of guys, you know, in a one-on-one workout setting are going to look like the all-stars or the near all-stars that they are. But Batum is a freak, man. He's just so fun to watch practice. He's so fun to watch work out, warm up. And he's not even playing defense in those situations. So you get him out there defensively, like, I'll tell you, my expectations could not be higher for him. I hope that he is fully healthy and able to ramp up, you know, his wind or, you know, his endurance ASAP so that, you know, come the playoffs or the stretch run, he's playing big minutes, bigger minutes than he did last year. And if that happens or not, who knows? You know, you're definitely right to raise the questions. Anyway, that's Batum. Anything else on the small lineup? Oh, yeah, one thing on the rebounding that you mentioned. See, this is where I was thinking that they might mix up some more zones too, you know, because they could just, you know, pack the paint with that second unit, have Batum in there as a four only with the second unit, make sure Aldridge is in there, and then just kind of pack the paint maybe with one of their matchup zones or maybe one of just their – you know, we'll dare you to shoot three-pointer zone, and then have five guys in the paint trying to grab rebounds.
Yeah, that's one way. I mean, I definitely give credit to the coaching staff. They're willing to be very creative in terms of covering for situations like that where they're going small, and I think they can come up with some things that to help with that.
Word. All right, so that was my one rebuttal, because people keep telling me about the whole rebounding thing too. I think there's a lot of people who agree with you that, you know, as good as he is defensively, it's really not going to matter if, you know, even if he takes his guy out of the play, if he can't get the defensive boards or him and Aldridge together can't get the defensive boards, then that whole plan of Batum as a four just fails right on the face of it. And I think that's a good argument. Definitely remains to be seen.
Well, I think the other thing that matters is how other teams match up with it. So if you've got teams that can make Batum pay in the post or something like that and they go big in response, then I don't think it works as well. But if you get teams to go small with players that – or lineups that they're not as comfortable with, and you're dictating the matchups, then I think that's where you really win.
Yes, I totally agree with you. It's nice when the Blazers dictate the matchups. I mean, we're so used to seeing the other way around, you know, the Blazers being forced to match up with other teams. But, like, when a guy like Andre Miller is just dictating to the Milwaukee Bucks, you have to stop me in the post, that's just as enjoyable as it gets for somebody who wants to see the Blazers succeed. Anyway, let's move on. So we talked about Nick. Let's look at some of these trade proposals that have been floating out there, and we're not going to get into a huge amount of depth about any of them, but just give me a quick thumbs up or thumbs down in terms of whether, you know, you think the Blazers should consider them. It seems like it's the topic that most people want to talk about, and yet I'm still not quite sure why, because, you know, like we said, the Blazers have been maintaining so well in the face of all these injuries. So we'll go through a couple of them. I think the number one most popular or most repeated one that seems to be out there is Andre Miller for Brendan Haywood. Or some other package of maybe Blake and Outlaw for Haywood and some other contract to come back. The idea being you get Haywood, who's on an expiring deal, to plug in immediately as your center, and then you don't necessarily owe him money next year when Oden and Prisbilla are hopefully back. And then you're getting rid of one of your extra point guards that you don't really need. Washington is adding a point guard, which they obviously could use now that Gilbert Arenas, their backcourt has been decimated a little bit by finger guns. What do you think?
I would say thumbs up. I really like Brendan Haywood. You know, I think he's a good fit. You're ideally, exactly looking for a guy like him who not only is A, demonstrably better than what Juwan Howard is giving you right now, but B, again, not an issue going forward, Marcin Gortat, for example, fits the first one. I don't know if you're planning to bring him up later, but he doesn't fit the second one because you have to figure out a way to trade him or do something else with that contract at the end of the year. So Haywood would really upgrade defensively quite a bit, I think, in terms of he's bringing you a shot-blocking presence like Prisbilla had. He's a solid rebounder. He's not the mid-range jump shooter maybe that you're getting with Haywood. It'd be very similar, I think, to having Prisbilla back if you had Haywood in the lineup. I think the only concern is what you're giving up in terms of those other two guys and what they might bring to you. If you lose Blake, you're definitely low on shooting in the backcourt. You're putting a lot more pressure on Miller and Bayless to contribute. But I would definitely make that trade if it's on the table.
Very interesting. Well, so Miller for Haywood, you'd do that. You just scrap the whole Miller signing, call it a bust, and then take Haywood. And what's your ceiling with that team? Second round of the playoffs? Or do you think that's, with Outlaw back and with Batum back, maybe that team now with Haywood plugged in and the same guards from last year with an improved Jared Bayless, maybe that team can go to the Western Conference Finals? Or, how far are you willing to take that?
To me, the Miller thing is irrelevant because I don't see Washington taking back a contract. So it would have to be a third team involved. And I'm not sure I see anyone who's going to want to deal expiring contracts for Andre Miller. So to me, that deal would have to be Blake and Outlaw for Haywood.
Very interesting. Okay. All right. I hear what you're saying. Yeah. I could see Washington just wanting to go into full liquidation mode. I don't think anyone would really blame them. That would make me, a little bit suspicious of why they would even want to deal Haywood, given that he's expiring,
Yeah, I think you'd probably have to throw something into that deal, like at least a second-round pick to make it worth Washington's while. I think Blake could be a good fit for them in terms of, you mentioned, their need at guard to some extent, but also he won the championship at Maryland. He started his career with the Wizards. He's probably a guy who's going to be, people are going to be happy to have there as a fan favorite, which I think the Wizards are looking to do whatever they can to rehabilitate their image at this point.
He definitely won't bring a gun into the locker room. I can guarantee that. Actually, that would be an interesting reality show, is like dropping Steve Blake into the Wizards' dysfunctional locker room and just seeing how long he could survive. I would feel really bad for Steve Blake if he got traded to the Wizards. Like, not that I would care that much if, he wasn't on the Blazers, but I'd be worried a little bit for his safety, And going from Portland, which is sort of like this locker room ideal, I swear Portland's locker room is kind of like that fake world in Avatar that, it's all like lush and green and just like happy and everyone's nice. I go in there, it's like this caring circle with like everyone holding hands and singing Kumbaya or whatever. And then going from that to Washington, where he gets shot just for going out in the shower, I feel bad for him. I'm not sure we want to trade that guy,
I have no response to that.
All right. So the next one up, Jeff Foster from Indiana. Similar situation. Another big, kind of a bruiser. Not uber talented. But would you have the same feeling towards Foster as you would towards Haywood, considering, similar packages to get it done?
Yeah, I'm not quite probably as high on Foster. I think he would be, a little bit less of an upgrade, but I think he definitely would help. He has another year on his contract, I think, is the big issue. So you're going to have him as your third center and be paying him quite a bit of money next year. And, already Jeff Pendergraft looks all overqualified as a third center. So, I think that's what might stop that trade from happening. But I do think he would be a help defensively. and on the boards, especially on the boards.
Okay, so what about one of the scenarios that we were floating at the Milwaukee game as we watched Elson and Gazurich go through their NBA Finals style pregame warm-up for the Brain Trust KP1, Mike Bourne, and Tom Penn, who all seem to be pretending not to watch, but kind of watching out of the corner of their eye as these 2 7-footers are jacking up three-pointers and dribbling the ball between their legs and showing off their versatility and running all over the court for absolutely no reason before a meaningless Wednesday game in which they didn't even really play. Did you think either one of those guys could get a lifeline out of Milwaukee, finish off their expiring contracts as a rental here in Portland, maybe with like Luke Ridenour, as we talked about, being part of a package that would go for Blake and Outlaw? What do you think about that? Now that you've had 48 hours to marinate on it, do you see either one of those guys being willing?
I'm giving all Dutch centers a thumbs down. I don't know who else is out there from the Netherlands who's a 7-footer and has an expiring contract, but no, I'm not seeing either of those guys as a big upgrade on Juwan Howard. Certainly not enough to, try to integrate a new point guard on the fly mid-season and give up, Travis Outlaw potentially coming back down the stretch and for the playoffs. So I'm gonna veto those ones. I know you're much more positive about those guys, so why don't you explain that?
No, I'm not at all. And I was just doing that because it was a fun thing to talk about. But the one benefit of that trade, if you were to do that, to trade Ridenour and say Gazurich for Blake and Outlaw, is that you get Ridenour in practice throwing up shots that LaMarcus can swat into like the 15th row, and you really increase his confidence. Because I don't know if you noticed that, but Ridenour got checked by Aldridge twice hard. I mean, that's probably the two hardest blocks of LaMarcus's season, back to back against Ridenour. So maybe you have Ridenour as like, the scout team point guard who throws up floaters that increases LaMarcus's defensive aggressiveness, and you turn him into a whole different player. You finally get him to that KG mode, if you will, by just repetition of blocking Ridenour shots in practice over and over, day in, day out. That has potential. That has a priceless monetary value that can't be quantified in an expiring contract.
Well, can we achieve the same effect by just telling Steve Blake to relentlessly drive the lane in practice?
Well, the only thing that Steve Blake does relentlessly is stand in the corner to shoot three-pointers. I think that's pretty much the only time he's relentless. All right, let's move on to a topic that we have not teased yet, and which I know you're a little bit bitter about discussing because this is your bread and butter. This is your high pick and roll when it comes to what draws traffic to Basketball Perspectives. So I'll be sure to put like 7 links to your website when I put up this podcast. But here's what we want to talk about: the rookie projections. Now, last year, you said, well, he wasn't a rookie, but you said Sergio Rodriguez was going to be the next John Stockton. I think you said Jared Bayless was going to be the next Michael Jordan. And you had, who else was, Nicholas Batum was going to be Scottie Pippen. And who else was, oh, Greg Oden was going to be the next Bill Russell. So you did all these statistical projections on the Blazers rookies, which I think so far have panned out perfectly. I think you're a 4 for 4, right?
Yeah, the Stockton to Malone part two with Sergio and John Brockman down in Sacramento is going well, so.
But anyway, summarize for people who are maybe new to the Wingcast how the projections work. Basically, you take their stats that they've already put up, compare them to stats that other peak players throughout history put up through that same number of seasons at that same age, and then try to statistically create a model for what the future production will look like.
Yeah, I mean, the key is kind of, the concept of similar players. I think Bill James basically invented it, like he did so many things in baseball. And he was using it for a slightly different purpose, trying to look at the Hall of Fame. But basically, we don't know what these players are going to become. Their futures are a mystery. And one way to maybe shed some light on it is to look at how guys like them have turned out in the past. So there's 13 different categories that go into this, including height and weight. And a lot of it it's both performance and also kind of stylistic elements, like how often they play on the perimeter as opposed to inside, things like that, that that look to get to guys who play similar ways and what that tells us about them. So, you know, we look at players who are within 6 months of the same age either way. Dante, I think at the end of the season, is going to be pretty much precisely 23 years old. So it's guys who were 22 and a half at the end of their rookie season to 23 and a half that we're comparing him to. So you think that's enough explanation? Should I get down to the list?
No, that's totally great. And, you know, the big benefit of doing these kinds of projections is that it helps either modify or clarify your initial impression of a new player. And it also is just fun to kind of bat around for what these guys' potential truly is. You know, and I'm as guilty of that kind of thing as anyone. You know, after basically, what, 3 games after Travis went down, I was on TV saying that Dante was going to be better than Travis. You didn't need to re-sign Travis because you had Dante. Dante's perfect replacement. You know, makes 1/6 of his salary, so why bother with Travis Outlaw? And it's that kind of knee-jerk reaction when you see a new player that, you know, once the league gets scouted, once people know what he can do, once they force him to do something outside of his comfort zone, once they learn how to exploit him on defense, you know, that thing gets, you know, you've got to modify your expectations for players like that. So the idea of the projections is to be a little bit less subjective, a little bit more objective, and see where these players actually stack up. So with that said, let's go ahead and start with Dante, because I do think, I still think after what we've seen from him, that the Blazers don't necessarily need to worry about bringing Outlaw back next year. I think they're pretty much covered in that backup 4 spot. What do the projections say about Dante Cunningham's performance to date?
Well, I think what you see usually when you look at young guys is a mix of various different players, and you got to kind of try and average them out, maybe something like that. So interestingly, by the way, Travis Outlaw is number 16 on Dante's list at the same age.
That's out of all NBA players going back to what year?
1980.
So you're talking about every NBA player over the last 30 years, Travis Outlaw is the 16th most like Dante Cunningham.
At the same age. I don't know how many, you know, there are at that age. You know, the number one guy on his list is, which is probably not real encouraging, is Brian Cook, who's now with the Houston Rockets. Kind of more of a true big man. You get a mix of true big men and more small types because of the way that Dante plays. Number two is Chris Humphreys, who just got traded to New Jersey. Terry Mills, who eventually developed into a three-point shooting power forward, even though he went about 270, and you know, had some very productive years in Detroit. Horace Grant is a name that will obviously be the most encouraging, one of the most encouraging on this list. Mike Sanders, who was a small forward in the 80s and early 90s, I remember mostly when he was with Cleveland with those Mark Price, Craig Elo teams. Jared Dudley, the Suns' third-year player, who's become a pretty nice contributor this year. Martin Mirsep, probably the most obscure of these guys, played for, I think, Miami. I think he was Finnish. But Terry Kaponen probably knows him. Bobby Simmons, who had one really good year for with the Clippers and parlayed it into a 6-year contract that was just a complete bust. Jerome Kersey is going to be the name that Blazers fans are probably most excited to hear. And then Alan Henderson.
So out of the top 10, you have 6 Hall of Famers, 2 perennial All-Stars. That's pretty good.
Yeah, we can start preparing that Hall of Fame bust for him now, right?
Yeah, well, exactly. So of those two names, obviously the two that jump are going to be Horace Grant and Jerome Kersey. When you assess Dante's skill set, what does he need to add if he's going to become a Horace Grant type player? I mean, Horace Grant, championship caliber player, great fit on those Bulls teams, did whatever he needed to do, had horrible vision, but he had goggles to correct it. I mean, great player, a player that you would love to have on a team that features a guy like Brandon Roy, you know, a guy like LaMarcus Aldridge, a guy like Greg Oden, you know, a great fit. If you could have, you know, Horace Grant in his prime on this team, you would be a foolish not to do that. What does he need to add to his game to get to that level, or to get to the level of Jerome Kersey of the early 90s?
Well, I think it's a matter of kind of picking the path. Is he going to be, you know, a bigger 3 player like Jerome Kersey was, or is he going to be a versatile 4 like Horace Grant was? You know, if he goes that way, he needs to become a better rebounder. If he's going to eventually play out in the perimeter, which I think might not be a bad fit for him, you know, we've seen that right now what he struggles with is kind of the footwork and defending those smaller guys, so that would be the big key for him.
Gotcha. I think he has a ways to go to get to those guys, but I think that's a reasonable ceiling for Dante. I mean, I don't think that's out of the question that, you know, I mean, let's say Horace Grant hadn't played for the Bulls he's still a nice player, you know, and even when he went to the Magic, he was still a valuable player. You know, and he had a very long, you know, healthy career. It seems like guys really like to play on his team. I mean, he's a good team guy. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that Dante has a career. That's his ceiling. I think that's a fair ceiling.
Yeah, I mean Horace Grant. I mean, I think that Horace Grant was one of the kind of the more underrated players in the NBA in the 90s, an even bigger factor in those first three Bulls championship teams than he got credit for. So if he got there, that would be huge. You know, Kersey would certainly be a very nice player, but it looks more, looking at this list, it's more like, you know, solid backup guy. You know, not huge upside, but you know, a guy who's going to be a useful contributor and stick around in the league for several years.
Cool. Let's do Pendergraph. Now, Pendergraph's been getting a lot of run lately because now he's in the middle of the Blazers warm-up circle doing like some crazy haka-style dance where he just kind of flips out for 45 seconds and then goes and sits down on the bench. I mean, he's a weird guy. I mean, he's quirky or whatever else you want to call him. You know, he's been a good contributor. He's very active. He's not afraid of anyone. He just does not care at all what anyone thinks of him, which is, you know, probably a great trade to have as a rookie center in the NBA. I mean, I'm not sure if you could have a better trade, if you, especially if you're a second round center, then I just don't care what people think about me, because that's going to take you so far in the NBA where everyone cares what everyone else thinks about them. Where does Pendergraph stack up? Now, granted, he's only played in what, 13, 14 games so far? How does he stack up so far? Where is he headed?
Well, the number one guy on this list, I think that, you know, this is probably a better list, I would say, all things considered. I will say the caveat is that Pendergraft has played so few minutes that his numbers are still a little weird. You know, his 2-point percentage is off the charts. So none of these guys are that similar. His steal rate is really low. His assist rate is really low. Obviously, he's not going to be good at those things, but it'll get better than he has it now. But so with that caveat, I think mostly a more encouraging list. Number one, Dale Davis, a guy who played in Portland at the tail end of his career. I think if Pendergraph becomes that, people will just be ecstatic. Josh Boone has had some decent years in New Jersey, kind of out of favor now. Bo Outlaw, Bo, don't call me Travis Outlaw. Stephen Hunter, David Lee, another guy who has been linked to the Blazers. Ed Neely is probably the worst of the guys on this list. Brendan Haywood, who we talked about earlier, Clifford Rozier, Travis Knight, who was kind of a one-year wonder as a rookie, and then Cliff Levingston is the odd guy out because he was like 6'8". I don't know why he's being compared to Pendergraft, but so generally, you know, a couple very solid players on there. David Lee might even be a borderline all-star. Dale Davis, I think, was an all-star at one point in his career. A pretty solid group.
That is a really nice group. Well, I think, boy, if you have Horace Grant and Dale Davis on this team, you're set. You know, you can't do much better in a second round than that. But Dale Davis is an interesting comparison. I think another guy who just didn't really care what people thought about him. You know, he was just going to go out there and do the dirty work and handle his business, and you were going to have to just deal with that. And that's not a bad thing to have. This team needed a little bit more of that. I think it was a really a conscious effort to get some of that in the draft last year. So that's good to hear that reaffirmation. Pendergraph, you know, in terms of where his career is headed, he got his second year guaranteed for next year, as far as I know. So he should be, you know, taken care of now through what would it be, the 11-12 season. So that's obviously a relief off his back. And now the Blazers are going to have to figure out what they're going to do with the draft this year. Now that they've got these, you know, both him and Dante on the books for next year, they're not going to have a ton of, you know, a ton of roster space, but I guess that's a question for a different podcast. Okay, so any other projections? Can we do an update on Jared Bayless? Where is he looking? And you know, after a season where he started off red hot from the mid-range, he's kind of cooled off on his jumper, his outside jumper especially. But he's doing great at getting to the basket. Has an, you know, incredible free throw rate. He's been making his free throws. He's actually done a little bit better job this season of working the offense, finding open shooters, you know, driving and kicking. All the kinds of things they were trying to drill into his head at Summer League last year. He's definitely shown progress, less fouls on defense.
Oh man, wow, the number one on his list is fascinating. His list is all over the place.
Let's hear it.
You're definitely going to laugh. Now, this is based just on this season. When we actually project his stats, we'll also use last year, which will hurt him, quite frankly. But number one, Harold Miner.
Oh, baby
I bet you
Jordan. Isn't
haven't heard
that
his name before.
perfect?
Number two, we're going from one extreme to the other. Number two, Darren Williams.
Wow. Well, yeah, no, I think that if you're going to describe Jared Bayless right now, it's pretty much 50% Darren Williams, 50% Harold Miner.
That's Darren Williams' rookie season before he really broke out. Number three, Lou Williams of the 76ers. Number four, Derek Chivas, who I vaguely recall having some NBA hoops cards of in the early 90s, but I think that's my only memory of Derek Chivas. Number five, Ray Allen.
Wow.
Number six, Dion Clutter.
Oh,
number
geez.
Seven, Jerry Stackhouse. Number eight, Larry Hughes. Number nine, Mo Williams. And number 10, Bassey Telfair. So,
interesting. This could go a lot of ways, is what you're saying.
This could be somewhere between Harold Miner and Terry Williams.
Bassey Telfair and Ray Allen, first time they've been in the same sentence together. Well, I think that's sort of, I mean, that's almost perfectly representative of how people feel, the general consensus about Jared Bayless, you know? He's either going to be Darren Williams or he's going to be Bassey Telfair. He's either going to be Ray Allen or he's going to be Harold Miner. I mean, it could go two different ways. He's still at that fork in the road. Have you seen anything in the minutes he's played that really gives you cause for concern in terms of, you know, what your expectations are of him? I mean, has he come in this season, you know, in his increased minutes, in his larger role, in his, you know, more consistent minutes too? And I mean, it's not just like he's playing 20 minutes one night, 0 minutes the next. I mean, he's been getting run pretty consistently. And he even got some run when Rudy came back. Has he done anything that gives you cause for concern about what he might develop into? Or would you say, you know, all indicators are good?
I would say the one thing is that, you know, I don't think that Bayless's stats usually are quite as good as he looks. And I think the big thing there is his two-point percentage still isn't real high. He doesn't hit a ton of threes. So basically he's relying on getting to the free throw line when he scores efficiently, which, you know, can be a challenge. But the fact that he is getting to the free throw line so much is a very positive indicator for him going forward. So, you know, I think that there's still that mix of very good tendencies and slightly more negative ones.
You know, the one thing that really is starting to drive me crazy is how often he gets blocked. He gets blocked like every third possession, it seems like, or every third
do you
drive.
Want the numbers on that?
What's that? No, we should run the numbers on that. I don't have them offhand. That's just a purely subjective, and maybe it's one of those things where it looks worse than it actually is, because it probably does. But it seems like every time he gets blocked, it goes back the other way for a layup or if, you know, a forced foul on the other end. If he doesn't get the call. Now, you kind of can't get calls if you don't risk getting blocked, so I understand and appreciate his aggressiveness, but it seems like he's still learning how to operate around the basket, learning how to maneuver his body to draw the contact and ensure that he gets the whistle. Sometimes he goes up anticipating contact that doesn't come, and it seems to throw him off. So I think he's still got, you know, a ways to go in terms of refining his ability to finish around the basket. But with that said, I just love watching his parade to the free throw line. When he can parade to the free throw line, it seems like Brandon gets more free throws. It seems like Miller maybe gets some more calls. And he really just kind of sets a different tone when he's getting fouls. So I think that's, you know, an underrated weapon. Or maybe not anymore. Maybe people are starting to come around to the idea that, you know, that's a really strong offensive weapon. I hope they are, because, you know, he's one of the better weapons the Blazers have. All right, any other projections we need to run? Or is that pretty much who we've got?
Wait, I was looking up the numbers for you. I thought you were filling for that. He's been blocked 7.9% of the time this season on 7.9% of the shot attempts, which is, you know, on a little high, but nothing real troublesome. Any guesses who the Blazer is who's been blocked the most frequently this season?
I'm not sure who.
Joel Prisbilla.
Ouch. Really?
14%. I would not have expected that. Brendan Haywood gets blocked on 12.3% of his attempts. But, yeah.
Prisbilla blocking himself? Anyway, all right. Anything else to talk about on the projections, or are we good to go there?
I think we're good there.
Okay, so let's go ahead and close this podcast on a, I guess, maybe a more humorous or more lighthearted topic. Let's put away the statistics, put away the rulers, graphing calculators, compasses, just put all that into the drawer. Let's go ahead and talk about, you know, the real substantive issue, which was Monday night before the Cleveland Cavaliers game, there was something of an incident. I think we should probably call it an incident or a maybe a confrontation between the best basketball player in the NBA, LeBron James. I think we can put to bed the LeBron versus Kobe argument, right? LeBron's better now, right?
Yes.
Okay. The best basketball player in the NBA, the best basketball player since Jordan?
Probably, yeah.
Okay. The best basketball player since Michael Jordan is going through his warm-ups, going through his shooting routines, draining shot after shot after shot nearly 2 hours before the game in a pretty much empty Rose Garden, you know, save a few riders, you know, a few players warming up, some coaches, a few media members. And everything's normal, just another night on the road for LeBron until four Blazer fans, you know, probably between the ages of maybe 14, 17, that range, come in, you know, wearing wristbands. And, you know, they're all dressed for the game. They got Blazer T-shirts, kind of just your typical, you know, high school basketball fans, you know, probably basketball junkies, probably listening to this podcast right now, probably bought your book, probably bought their book for their dads, that kind of, those kinds of kids. You know, they're obviously into it. They're obviously with it. They're obviously extremely pumped up to be in the presence of LeBron James, international celebrity, businessman, mogul, brand, Nike pitchman, so on and so forth. So for whatever reason, one of them decides to, and I don't know why, I would just assume it was because they were in awe and they wanted to touch LeBron, you know, sort of like people used to want to touch Michael Jackson, you know, if he'd be in public. And Michael Jackson obviously liked to touch people too. That's a different story. But, you know, people would just want to reach out and touch Michael Jackson. Because, you know, he's just – you almost can't believe he's real when you see him on TV. So for whatever reason, one of the kids decides it's going to be a good idea for him to kind of pat LeBron on the butt after LeBron shoots. And I think maybe his idea was he wants to be one of the guys. You know, it's kind of a common thing to do in basketball, to, you know, pat your teammate on the butt as a sign of encouragement. So LeBron's shooting in the right-hand corner, misses a three-pointer. He's kind of waiting for the ball to be retrieved. And the kid kind of comes up to slap LeBron on the butt, and I do think he got a little bit more flesh maybe than he was anticipating, and maybe a little bit more contact than would be deemed acceptable even in the NBA. And, you know, he kind of withdrew eventually, and LeBron had headphones in, like I said, just rips them out of his ears, turns around, and is just completely shell-shocked that this would have happened. I mean, he can't believe it. And when he sees who had done it, you know, high school kids, you know, the kinds of people who probably wear his shoes, kinds of people who probably saw his movie, bought his book, you know, watch him on TV, vote for him on the All-Star game. And you just can't believe that these kinds of kids would do that, or one of those kids would do that. And don't they realize who he is, was kind of the look on his face. And also probably, you know, fairly startled that someone had touched him in a place where not a lot of people probably touch him, especially in public. Especially without asking him, you know, especially without, you know, knowing him. So, you know, LeBron kind of surveyed the scene to see, I think, and this is me kind of projecting thoughts into LeBron's head, but I think he was kind of looking around to see if anyone else had seen it had happened. I can't say that for sure, but that's what it kind of seemed like he was doing, just to make sure that, you know, this had really happened and, you know, what were these kids doing? And he kind of stomps off back to half court and just starts swearing up a storm. I can't even say the words on the wing cast. I mean, he's saying words that are even worse than the filth that we play as a filler between our segments. I mean, it's pretty heavy swear words he's chucking at these kids to his teammates, you know, kind of relaying what had just happened. And he couldn't believe it. And his teammates, you know, to their credit, tried to downplay the incident, tried to say, oh, maybe it's just supporting you, tried to help him laugh it off a little bit. And he just kept going. And the kids were looking off in a different direction, trying not to make eye contact, trying to pretend to be invisible. And, you know, Bron is just continuing to go. So eventually they kind of slink off because, you know, they obviously it hadn't played out like they thought it was going to play out. Who knows? Maybe they thought LeBron was going to give them an autograph or maybe pat them on the head or, you know, who knows what they thought LeBron was going to do. But it didn't happen that way. And, you know, after they finally left, LeBron kind of calmed down. And he ended up getting back into his shooting routine eventually. But it was a really strange contrast for a guy that loves to be the center of attention, loves the adulation, does the chalk dust cloud before the games, shoots underhanded half-court shots, during, warm-ups, kind of to the crowd's amusement. I mean, the ultimate showman, probably the best showman in the NBA since Jordan or Magic. I kind of described his entire game as like a Magic show, really. I mean, he's just got so many tricks up his sleeve. He almost doesn't seem real, some of the things he does around the basket, what he does on the fast breaks. And yet, to kind of see that cape pulled back a little bit to see what he was really like when he's kind of taken out of his element was kind of shocking, you know? I mean, I just almost couldn't even believe that LeBron would react that way, or that really anyone would react that way.
So anyway, telling that story on Blazers Edge resulted in a ton of Cavalier fans' emails and also some other bloggers emailing to say, well, what did you expect LeBron to do? I mean, the guys, grabbed him on the butt. They touched him in a place that's not appropriate, and there wasn't security around to deal with it. You know, shouldn't he be upset? Shouldn't he be outraged? And at the time, I kind of thought, no. I mean, I thought he overreacted. Looking back on it, is it understandable that he would be that taken aback, that personally offended? I guess that's kind of a personal judgment. And one person asked me, hey, let's say you're in the press room and you're writing, and someone randomly comes up and taps you on the butt, how are you going to react? And I just thought, I'd probably be shocked and just be kind of like, what? I don't think I would go into a profanity-laced tirade and try to intimidate the people out of my presence. So I put it to you, KP2. If someone had done that to you, how would you react? And do you think that LeBron's reaction, now granted you didn't see it, but as I've described it, as witnessed by multiple people, does that sound like an appropriate, fair reaction? I mean, does that make you think less of LeBron as a person based on how he acted?
Well, it's kind of interesting. When I read the story in Blazers Edge, apparently I skimmed it a little too much because my interpretation of it was one of the ball boys who had given him the
No.
This is kind of much more disconcerting to me. I mean, how did these kids get on the floor? There was no security there to keep them on the floor, off the floor?
No, and there's definitely a security issue there because normally fans are not allowed into the games before either 60 or 90 minutes before, generally 60 minutes before. So obviously they knew somebody who knew somebody. I mean, there's ways to get in. If you know the employees, they can get you in a door. Or if you know maybe a Nike rep, or if you whoever you may know, you can get in earlier. But there's definitely a security issue there in that although these kids were harmless, the fact that somebody was able to get onto the court early, that's definitely a pressing security issue. Now, with that said, I will tell you that a member of the Rose Garden security team contacted me via email to say that they had reviewed my story as part of one of their debriefings to kind of discuss how they would adjust potentially, when they're out there or how they handle situations before the game to ensure the player's safety. So the irony of all of this is that I may have ended up making LeBron safer, potentially, going forward.
My first thought when I hear the story this way is Monica Seles. Like, if someone comes up and hits me and I'm LeBron and I don't know who it is and all of a sudden I see someone I don't recognize who doesn't seem like they're supposed to be on the floor, I'm going to be kind of concerned. I'm going to be concerned about my safety, definitely. So I don't know if that excuses, going as far in terms of an overreaction as he did, but I think it definitely it makes more sense that way.
Well, here's the thing, though. Monica Seles, wasn't she attacked by, like, a vampire in a trench coat?
I mean, I'm sure it wasn't a 16-year-old kid, but,
I think that was one of the issues, that it was difficult to convey in the writing that, some people took issue with. There's a lot of people, they did feel that LeBron's safety or, even his privacy was put at risk by these kids. And I think at first glance, when you looked at this kid, and I think it's fair to say this, these are, like, the most non-threatening kids ever. I mean, this is, like, your typical basketball stan, The guy who probably has a binder of basketball cards at home. Pacey little kids in high school, not threatening to someone of LeBron's stature in any meaningful way. Now, the fact that they got in there, certainly I think that's a threat, but the actual kids themselves, so when you're wheeling around to look at them, it's not like you're wheeling around to some like knife wielding maniac. You're wheeling around to kids that probably go on basketball prospectus on their lunch break in high school.
Basically the equivalent of us in high school.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They almost look like my younger brother. So I'm not going to be intimidated of that if I'm LeBron. But so putting aside the security issue, though, and maybe you can't put aside the security issue. Maybe this is all a security issue to some people.
I don't think you can put it aside. I think it's got to be a factor.
Okay. But nevertheless, once his security is known to him to be not compromised, which happened relatively quickly as soon as he was able to walk freely over to his teammates, right? Do you think less of him based on that presentation, or do you think, hey, this guy's legitimately scared? And if he is legitimately scared, isn't it a little strange how he could be so taken out of his element, so scared by, you know, what look at first glance to be innocent kids when he goes toe-to-toe with some pretty scary guys on the court who are looking to, in some cases, you know, foul him and give him, you know, bodily harm on the exact same court he's on during the situation, and he has a completely different reaction? You know, is it just that he's not ready for it that early before the game? He was caught off guard? I mean,
yeah, you can't compare the two because that's a known situation that he understands, his experience, and can control, as opposed to something that, you know, feels out of his control. So I don't think that's a relevant comparison to me. I mean, I agree that the reaction was too strong, and, you know, I don't see what, once he realized, you know, I mean, it's just venting his frustration at some point, which is, you know, all anger, I guess, for all of us. But, I mean, I think it's a more legitimate concern for him than I think you think it is.
Well, no, I'm not saying it's not a legitimate concern. It's just one that hadn't come up initially when I was thinking about it, when I was writing about it, that, you know, yeah, I guess he maybe was a little bit scared. Because if you see these kids, they're just not scary people. You see LeBron, and LeBron is a physical specimen. He has the best body in the NBA. I don't think there's anyone who has a better body. I think he's above Dwight Howard. And I don't know who would even be three in that discussion. You know,
I don't think he's bulletproof, so.
That's very true, and I think that probably speaks more to, you know, us putting, or me putting LeBron on some sort of a pedestal that maybe, you know, he still is human at the end of the day, and it's not unfair for him to feel scared or threatened by, you know, situations that he's not used to. But I also did think it was a little bit, you know, interesting that in the end, this was not a huge incident. You know, he probably forgot about it by the next morning. I'm sure the kids won't forget about it. I'm sure they're going to remember this incident for the rest of their life, which is kind of a shame. I mean, it's a shame that they had to go out of their way to interrupt LeBron during his routine, but it's also a shame that, you know, they're going to look at LeBron differently for the rest of their life. I mean, he certainly made them feel less than human in his response. So I feel a little bit of sympathy towards them.
I don't know. What's the old Mel Brooks line? Tragedy plus time equals humor. I think at some point this is a hell of a story to tell.
Well, I was willing to tell the story 3 hours later. And actually, I told the story at the arena probably 15 times. But for the kids, I mean, the kids, I'm not sure if it's the greatest story for the kids. It's like, yeah, I grabbed LeBron's butt, and then he cussed me out. Is that a story?
That's pretty funny. Again, you know, in the moment, it's horrible for them. But at some point, it becomes a pretty funny story to tell their kids.
Well, see, and here's another angle that some people took exception to, is they don't see any humor in a stranger grabbing another stranger in that way, or even touching another stranger in that way. And the idea that, you know, this was potentially a sex crime that the kid committed upon LeBron. Where do you – no, and don't laugh. People legitimately made this argument, and I could kind of see what they're saying. I mean, I don't take it that way. Definitely in the context, I didn't take it that way. But where do you fall on that?
I mean, I think it probably startled LeBron more than if someone patted him on the shoulder. But, no, I wouldn't go that far.
All right. That's fair enough. Well – it's funny that the three games this week you decided to go to, the one that you missed was the LeBron show. It was the one where he puts up a near triple-double with 40 points, and this goes down before the game. You really missed out, KP2.
Yeah, I had a family event that was poorly scheduled, as it turned out.
Well, that's too bad. All right. Well, anything else on that subject, or are we Oh, another issue that got raised by that was whether or not that kind of a story should become public. And that how we're in a new era of internet journalism and, you know, that kind of a thing 10 years ago when Jordan was playing. The same thing happened to Jordan, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Does that come out or how does that work? And maybe the short story should be off limits because it didn't happen during the game or didn't happen during one of the press conferences post game. And my response to that is, like, these are the kinds of stories that get out in the kind of the tell-all books after the season, you know, the 7 seconds or less kind of books.
I think of the Jordan rules.
Yeah. The Jordan rules kinds of books tell these kinds of stories on a regular basis. And so I don't see why that kind of a story, you know, given the platform of the internet, is not a story. I mean, that seems like a story to me. He's in a public space. You know, the writers are clearly present. That seems like that seems like a story that can be run, and I can see why other writers, especially Cavs beat writers, maybe wouldn't write that story, but that seems like a fair story to me. Would you agree?
I'm generally a fan of transparency, so I think so. And I think one of the things that, you know, Ball 4 is probably the classic example of this going back several decades. But part of the reason those books, tell-all books, used to feel so shocking is because, you know, there was more of a mythology and, you know, that surrounded these players. And I don't know that that's necessarily a good thing. So to have that kind of, you know, be shattered, you know, gradually, so to speak, instead of all at once, might not be so bad for the player or the fans.
Indeed. Hey, one thing that we shouldn't get lost in this whole story, and let's wrap it up on this thought, is how good LeBron is. I mean, we only get – and unfortunately here in Portland, we only get to see him once a year in person. But the things that he does on a play-by-play basis are just next level, next world. I mean, his fourth-quarter passing out of those left isolations when the Blazers are just trying to anything possible that would be different to kind of mix him up, and he's just picking it apart play after play after play. Not even to mention his incredible first quarter where he doesn't miss a shot and puts up 20 points. This guy is something serious. And you know, the fact that Cavs fans are able to see him 82 nights a year, and that's pretty special. And they deserve to have a player like that. So Cavs fans, if you're listening, thinking that we're trying to bag on LeBron, that's not true. LeBron, best player in the league, nothing but respect for him as a player. Wish he had handled that situation a little bit differently, but in hindsight, I could see why he'd be upset. All right.
Well, I'm pretty furious. It's been 2 years now I haven't seen LeBron, so the last time was where they came into – actually, no. Did he play? He might not have played the last time the Cavs played at Key Arena. It may have been like 3 years since I've seen LeBron now. That's terrible.
Do you even know who LeBron is?
Barely.
Well, you need to get out there. You should probably just move to Cleveland. Actually, well, he's not going to be back in Cleveland next year, so where should you move to? Miami?
Yep.
New York? The Empire State of Mind? All right, take it easy, KP2. We'll talk again maybe next week. I became more curious. Fuck being up north, delirious, more serious. So killer did mixtapes. CEOs heard, now here come Big Cake. But one cat said, Cam, you better recoup. For you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot. The best rap dealer all time next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, my own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clap game. For that fame, grow entertainment. Sports, drugs, entertainment. To the arraignment killer. Come street.